Today on Against the Grain, how did a Scottish moral philosopher of the Enlightenment become an apostle of the libertarian right in this country? Political theorist Glory Liu traces the uses of the complex ideas of Adam Smith in the United States, from the establishment of the U.S. state through debates about slavery and inequality, to justifying the retreat of the state in our era. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Think of Adam Smith, and you'll likely come up with a notion that the common good is best served by people pursuing their self-interest, an idea beloved by the economic right. But Smith was a wide-ranging thinker and moral philosopher whose ideas have often been fought over or remembered very narrowly. My guest today argues that for over 2.5 centuries, Smith's ideas have been claimed for very different purposes. Glory Liu is the author of Adam Smith's America, How a Scottish Philosopher Became an Icon of American Capitalism. That's published by Princeton University Press. Glory, although your book is about how Adam Smith is read and interpreted, that is, that what Adam Smith really meant is not the focus of your book, I wonder if you could give us a brief history of his life and key works.
So Adam Smith is a man of the Scottish Enlightenment. He was born in 1723 in a small seaside town called Kirkcuddy, which is just several miles outside of the kind of most well-known city of Edinburgh. He attends the University of Glasgow and then moves on to the University of Oxford. We don't know too much about his life as a youth, though he was very bright. And then he returns after his time at Oxford to deliver lectures on rhetoric and belles lettres and moral philosophy and eventually jurisprudence. And it's during his time as a freelance lecturer that he becomes acquainted with some of the heavyweights of the Scottish Enlightenment, most importantly, his best friend and mentor, David Hume. That's in the 1750s. He later is appointed to become the University of Glasgow's Professor of Moral Philosophy. He teaches rhetoric and moral philosophy at the University of Glasgow. And it's during his time as a professor at the University of Glasgow that he publishes his first major work, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, in 1759. In the 1760s, he becomes tutor to the young Duke of Buccleuch, who is the stepson of the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Charles Townshend. And as the Duke's tutor, he travels throughout Europe. So they're in Paris and Geneva and Toulouse. And then, unfortunately, they have to return early. But it's during this time in the 1760s that Smith is exposed to a whole new world of ideas and interlocutors that inform his writings on political economy. So when he returns, he begins writing the book that would later become The Wealth of Nations. This is between the 1760s and 1770s. That magnum opus, The Wealth of Nations, or An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, is published in 1776, that year that we as Americans know is a very fateful year. And Smith's reputation is already very high, but this book becomes a bestseller within his lifetime. He later retires in Edinburgh with his mother, who he lived with for most of his life. And it's between 1776 and 1790 that he begins revising both The Wealth of Nations, but also returns to the theory of moral sentiments and embarks on projects that he never finished. He had planned a work on the history of law and government, as well as a history of kind of literary studies and poetry. But he dies in 1790, and it's right before his death that he orders all of his unfinished manuscripts to be burned. And this is one of the most frustrating facts about his life for his biographers and for scholars, because all of us want to know, what did he have planned in those works, and we're never going to be able to recover them. So that's the arc of Smith's life. I can say more if you want about kind of the context in which he lived, but hopefully that gives you a sense of the man's intellectual trajectory and the timeline of his major works.
Well, I wonder if you could talk about those two works, The Theory of Moral Sentiments and The Wealth of Nations, you know, as you illustrate in your book, books where the ideas are contested and interpreted in all sorts of different ways, including in the United States. In broad brushstrokes, what are the key arguments of those two books?
So The Theory of Moral Sentiments is a work of 18th century Enlightenment moral science. And it can be helpful to break down the title and explain how each of these words means something and conveys what's in the book. That's what I do when I teach this. So Theory of Moral Sentiments. Smith is providing an explanatory theory. I would call it a kind of phenomenological theory of what determines moral behavior. He's not interested in laying down moral precepts and saying, you know, here are five rules of how to be a good person. Instead, he's interested in explaining the phenomenon of morality itself. What is it like when we experience things that will become moral judgments? How do we feel that we do something right or wrong? So he paints a very rich, descriptive, humanistic portrait of what the experience of morality is like, how it is that we come to moral rules. Now, that term moral in the 18th century is a bit more capacious than the way we use it now. We tend to use that word moral now to mean something like ethical, like did you do something moral, did you do something right or good? In Smith's time, the word moral really was used in contrast to physical or natural. So the physical universe, right, nature, the laws of physics, the laws of non-human nature versus moral, which meant something more like psychological and social. And then sentiments. Here, Smith is kind of gesturing to a large debate in 18th century moral science about whether morality was grounded in reason or sentiment. And here he's siding on the line of sentiment, right? Do we come to know what is right and wrong through reason and deduction and logic, or is it based in our feelings? So when you put those words together, right, the theory of moral sentiments, you get a sense of what it is that Smith is laying out to do. So there's not one specific main argument of the book. Rather, there is a kind of foundational theory or set of ideas and concepts that Smith lays out. So the kind of linchpin of the work is this idea that we come to understand our morality, our rules of right and wrong, through the mechanism of sympathy. Sympathy means fellow feeling with other human beings. We learn to put ourselves in another person's shoes. It's this act of imaginative projection. We imagine what it's like to be in somebody else's position, and then we evaluate how we might feel in their position. And that is this, it's both a mechanism, right, of how we come to make moral judgments, but it's also the object of our desires. We want to be sympathized with, we want to be the object of sympathy. And it's through this process of sympathetic exchange that we learn to kind of regulate our passions and regulate our feelings and evaluate our own behavior. So that is how Smith comes up with his theory of morality. And again, it's an incredibly rich portrait of human life in its kind of most fundamental, in its most fundamental building blocks and elements, right? What is going through our minds when we hear our brother being tortured on the rack? That is the first image that Smith paints in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, right? It's this vivid image. And he And the reason why I think it's such a powerful image is because he's putting ourselves in this thought experiment when he says, imagine one of the closest companions, your brother, being tortured on the rack. You're hearing his screams and you're hearing his torments. What is going through your mind? Well, you have to imagine what might be your brother might be experiencing because you yourself can't experience it. And then you have to imagine, okay, how would I feel in that position? So immediately he's kind of painting us with this very vivid, imaginative, a combination of both like physical, emotional, psychological, all rolled into one. And then he's asking the reader to say, now let's walk through this process. What is it that you would feel and how would you evaluate this position? And that's the mechanism, or that would say that's the avenue into understanding how Smith is, how Smith wants us to understand the foundations of morality. So hopefully that's enough of a teaser for listeners to want to pick up the book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and find out a little bit more.
And less likely to have been put on the curriculum of their undergraduate education if they had it than the other book, The Wealth of Nations.
100%. Yeah. I mean, as somebody who was a professional Smith scholar, I had not read The Theory of Moral Sentiments until I was in graduate school. I didn't even know the work existed. It turns out there's a reason for that. And that's why I decided to write the book that I did. I am a big fan of The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And if you want a riveting read that really opens up a window into the human psyche, I can't recommend the Theory of Moral Sentiments highly enough. In fact, when I teach it to my students, they love it and they think, oh my God, it's like Smith is getting inside my head. That's what it's like to read this book.
And then what about The Wealth of Nations? People are likely to be more familiar with that, but often excerpts. How would you characterize the general arguments that he's making in The Wealth of Nations?
Great big question. So I'm going to do the exercise that I did with The Theory of Moral Sentiments to kind of distill this down to its essence. The full title of the book is An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. And I think that clues us into what Smith is setting himself up to do. So it's an inquiry. It's not a manifesto. It's not a critique. It's not, you know, a pamphlet. He's laying out a set of questions, puzzles, frameworks, and problematics. The nature and causes. He's interested in advancing his own theory of what the nature of national wealth is. And I'm going to get to that idea of nations rather than individuals in just a second. But also the causes of national wealth, right? What causes wealth to increase or decrease? What thwarts its progress? And then it's the nature and causes of the wealth of nations, right? This is not economics as shopping, economics as the science of value or individual wealth. This is not a handbook for how to maximize the return on your interest. This is a book about the progress and wealth of nations. And so I think when you see this larger architecture of the work, you realize that this is very much not like an intro to economics textbook that you would pick up today. It's something much broader in scope and much more specific to the time that Smith was writing in and reflecting some of the enormous changes that he was witnessing on a global scale. And I'll talk about those in just a moment. Yes, there are foundational economics concepts in here. He talks about rent, he talks about price and wages and labor, market price and natural price and things like that. But that's just a tiny sliver of this broader field that Smith opened up that he calls political economy. If economics is about how we meet our needs, right, and market exchange is one way in which we meet those needs, barter is another way of meeting those needs, feudalism is a way of meeting those needs. Political economy is the science of understanding the laws, the institutions, the norms that structure the way in which humans meet our needs. And Smith takes us through a huge history in Book 3 of The Wealth of Nations, but elsewhere in the Book 2, of how it is that human institutions have changed over time in ways that enhance and enable and facilitate growth, but also in ways that thwart it or in ways that promote violence, extraction, and exploitation. And so when you read The Wealth of Nations as a whole, you get an incredibly rich complex and deep picture of the history of politics and power and human institutions that shapes the way economies work at the national level, but also in a global scale.
Political theorist and historian Glory Liu is my guest. We're discussing her book, Adam Smith's America, How a Scottish Philosopher Became an Icon of American Capitalism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifico Radio. So then how were Adam Smith's major works received during the founding era of the United States? Because your book focuses on the reception of Smith's ideas in the United States over 2.5 centuries. Were the Wealth of Nations and the Theory of Moral Sentiments equally available and read by the elite group that would have read him?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of framing it. And I would say they were equally available, not necessarily in terms of, you know, the specific quantities of the books that were imported, but I would say they were read more or less on par with one another in terms of the sensibilities that resonated with the educated elite. So I focus on people like the founding fathers, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Alexander Hamilton. These are kind of key figures who are in the business of statecraft and statesmanship. And these are men who are searching for reservoirs of ideas that will help them understand America's place in the world before and after independence. And they're looking for this kind of reason-based way to understand the human condition, so how it is that humans relate to one another, how to understand and have a kind of how to kind of cultivate a critical mind. So that's where the theory of moral sentiments offered a way to understand the foundations of human morality and virtue and provide some kind of foundation for understanding how you might best cultivate the capacity for morality and virtue. And also the Wealth of Nations. Again, these are statesmen and they're thinking about how is it that America can maintain her political and economic independence from Great Britain in an age of empire? And so both the theory of moral sentiments and the Wealth of Nations offer incredibly powerful resources for leading statesmen to not only reflect on their own ideas, but also offer new ideas, in fact, the most cutting edge ideas at the time about everything from virtue and morality and the relationship between human virtue and institutions, but also everything from finance, to trade. These are big questions for statesmen who are really at the helm of steering the ship of state.
Yeah, so on that, what did Alexander Hamilton, Secretary of the Treasury, who now, of course, I'm asking this question from the present, but could hardly be called a paragon of the free market, what did he draw from the Wealth of Nations?
Super interesting, because you would think that somebody like Hamilton, who was pro infant industry support, right? Things like having the government be very active in promoting certain industries, providing bounties, what we would call subsidies, to certain sectors of the manufacturing industries. And also in favor of modest tariffs to protect American development against much more developed and competitive rivals, specifically Great Britain. You would think that he would be the most anti-free trade, anti-Adam Smith reader, but in fact, he uses Smith's ideas to kind of provide this very critical foundation about how wealth is produced in the first place, right? So going back to what I mentioned earlier about the title, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, Hamilton basically cribs Smith's idea about the division of labor and how it enhances productivity. And he takes this entire passage about the division of labor and how it works by increasing dexterity and saving time, using machines, to say, look, this is one way in which productivity is increased, and we can do this here in this country, and we need an activist government to kind of help get things going in a way in a way that makes us competitive and able to compete with our foreign rivals. And so the way in which he uses Smith is quite sneaky here, because he's taking the like architecture of how we think about national wealth, but has a much more realistic vision of how America in this very infant stage needs to be supported by a much more interventionist government in order to be competitive on an international stage. And I will say that the scholarly consensus on this is not that Hamilton misread Smith in any way, but in fact that Smith's own views about trade and about infant industry protections were actually pretty Hamiltonian in their orientation too. So this is not an unusual reading of Smith by any means, but it says something, and this is why kind of reception history is so illuminating. It really shows what are the demands that readers are bringing to Smith's text, and why does Smith become important? It's because they're living in this moment where they're trying to figure out what does growth look like? How do we maintain political and economic independence? And what are the resources available to us at the time? That's why we get these kinds of readings of Smith, and that's why Smith is so important for people like the Founding Fathers.
You've been describing the tradition of political economy and the sort of concerns that someone like Smith grappled with. What happened in the 19th century to that discipline, if one can call it that, in the United States? How did it shift, and what role did the ideas, or the received ideas anyway, of Adam Smith play in that reshaping?
Great question. So before I answer the question about the 19th century, I'll just reemphasize, what is it like in the 18th century? What did Smith mean by political economy? So for Smith and for people like the Founding Fathers, political economy is a branch of the science of the legislator. It is a branch of politics. It is statesmanship, but it's also this very practical science of how you think about the world, given the evidence provided by history, and how you can kind of best manage the nation's wealth. So it is a branch of politics. By the mid 1800s, around 1820s to 1830s, political economy becomes an academic discipline. It becomes a field of knowledge production. So you start to see more courses being taught on political economy in higher education institutions. It's seen as a way to educate the nation's elite so that they become good statesmen and that they understand the best way to kind of cultivate the national economy. But it also is a branch of kind of, as I said, like it is a science. It is in the business of producing new theories and new ideas to add to the stock of human knowledge. And so with the kind of proliferation of the field of political economy, you get authors, mostly, you know, these academics, university presidents writing their textbooks, playing with Smith's ideas and revisiting them and thinking through which of Smith's ideas are most useful, not only for instruction and teaching, but which of them apply specifically to the American context in the 1830s and 1840s. So what happens are kind of this transformation of Smith in two important ways. First, you have Smith becoming founding father of political economy. He gets founding fatherized. So as the discipline is developing, people are beginning to realize Smith did something really important. He founded the science. He gave it form and structure, and he kind of laid out its central problematics. So Smith takes on an intellectual authority of his own. Even for people who disagree with Smith's precepts or with Smith's specific positions on things like trade, for instance, they still say, nevertheless, he is the founder of the discipline, right? And so it's through this process of critique and revision and the creation of American political economy for American audiences that Smith becomes its founding father. So his intellectual authority is solidified. At the same time, the actual American political economy is undergoing transformation. Importantly, you have, you know, the growth. It's like very early pre-industrialization, but we're still in this period where the nation's future in terms of what it looks like as an economy is still uncertain, right? It's not fully agricultural. It's not fully industrialized yet. You have very regional based economies, so the plantation, cotton south, which relies heavily on chattel slavery, and the more manufacturing, slowly industrializing north, right? These economies are entangled with one another, but they have very different visions for what the national political economy will look like. And this is also inseparable from the question of slavery and ultimately the stage of the Civil War. Now, the way in which I discuss this in my book is really around the idea of free trade, or I should say the debates about free trade. So between the 1820s and 1860s, free trade becomes the flashpoint for thinking about not only the national political economy, but thinking with Adam Smith. So in addition to his intellectual authority as the father of political economy, Smith becomes the lightning rod for debates about free trade, which are debates about slavery and the future of the American political economy. And on the one hand, you have people who are free trade advocates saying, you know, Smith is the apostle of free trade. It is because he laid down the foundations of the science of political economy, this universal science that tells us that free trade is not only objectively and scientifically validated, but the right thing for our nation, right? He authorizes this vision of political of the American political economy as being a free trade nation. Now, a lot of these advocates for free trade are coming from the South. And, you know, there's this inherent contradiction here that they're advocating for a national economy that they call free trade, but is built on the backs of the most unfree labor, namely slave labor. Now, on the other hand, you have people advocating for not protectionism in its most hardened sense, but what they're calling national political economy. You know, they're saying we need protections in order to keep American industries more competitive. We want to move more towards manufacturing and industrial production rather than, you know, the exportation of agricultural cash crops. And those in favor of what's called the American system use Smith as a foil. They say, well, Smith might have been the apostle of free trade, but even Adam Smith advocated for the protection of the home market, the most important market of all. So what happens over the course of these free trade debates, which rage before and after the Civil War, is that Smith becomes little more than a totem or a symbol to align yourself with or distance yourself from in order to signal your position on the politics of free trade, right? So for some, he's the apostle of free trade. What he says is gospel. For others, he might have been the gospel of free trade, but he even made exceptions for this, for propping up American industries. So this is the period that I find most interesting because Smith becomes this political symbol, and it sets this pattern for politicizing Smith in these very charged but also very narrow ways, ideologically and politically narrow ways.
Right, which arguably has continued to the present. I'm speaking with the author of Adam Smith's America, How a Scottish Philosopher Became an Icon of American Capitalism. Its author is Glory Liu. She is Assistant Director for the Center for Economy and Society and Assistant Research Professor at Johns Hopkins. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and we're talking about the contested reception of Adam Smith's ideas in the United States. Now, in the late 19th century, Smith's Lectures on Jurisprudence is discovered. Could you tell us what the significance of those lectures were for the debates of the time?
Yes. This is a really remarkable discovery. So these are student notes on Smith's Lectures on Justice, Police, Revenue, and Arms. Now, they're now known as the Lectures on Jurisprudence. And once they're discovered, there's this huge surge in commentary coming mostly from Europe. Commentary on Smith's intellectual development, the historical significance of these lectures, where they fit in between the theory of moral sentiments and the wealth of nations, and really what Smith could have been up to. And the reason these lectures are important are because not only do they provide more textual resources for scholars to work with, but because they introduce a new set of problematics, a new set of questions that become these enduring puzzles about how we read Adam Smith and what his significance is. So the most important of these is known as Das Adam Smith Problem. And this was, given its title, introduced by some German scholars in the late 19th century that raised the question of the consistency of Adam Smith, right? How could Smith have thought that human beings were sympathetic and that the world, the human world, is kind of governed by sympathy and altruism on the one hand, and then in The Wealth of Nations, he turns towards this idea of self-interest, right? How could these be compatible with one another? How could these two works have been, you know, even be written by the same author? Now, the lectures on jurisprudence complicates Das Adam Smith problem because it looks like there could be a link between the two, insofar as Smith's ideas about political economy get introduced much earlier than previously supposed, and we have evidence for this because of the existence of the lectures on justice, police, revenue, and arms. But the other reason they're important is because they show another side of Smith, thinking about law, thinking about politics, thinking about the foundations of government and political authority. And this is where we start to see commentary around Smith as a historical thinker, a historicist thinker. And this is particularly appealing to a cohort of American economists who did their graduate training in Germany, and they kind of bring back this German historical sensibility to how they're teaching and doing economics in the late 19th century. And that's inflected into their readings of Smith. And what really comes out of their readings of Smith and the lectures on jurisprudence, but also Smith and the theory of moral sentiments and The Wealth of Nations more generally, is that they start to see Smith as what they call a kind of humanitarian thinker, right? Somebody who was an economist, but really was sensitive to the contingencies of history, to the human condition, somebody who cared deeply about the poor, about solving social problems. And this resonated with the problems of their time, right? They were highly attuned to the labor question, and the relationship between ethics and economics. So their present questions about the relationship between ethics and economics, the way in which we do economics as a historical discipline, not just abstract theorizing, those get projected onto their readings of Smith as well, as there are these new discoveries about what Smith himself had written.
Well, let me ask you more about that. You know, you're contending that we shouldn't see ideas in the abstract, that ideas, including the reception of ideas, have to be viewed in the context of their times. In the late 19th century, early 20th century, it was a period of enormous inequality, a great deal of class struggle, of capitalism unbound, and elite disregard for the poor. All themes that presumably Smith has something to say about. How do you see the context of that period shaping the way his ideas were received?
That's such a great question. When I was doing the research for that chapter on the late 19th century, the kind of progressive era, and this group of, they're called the new generation economists writing in the progressive era and advancing what I call a kind of progressive interpretation of Smith, I saw so much resonance with the way in which Smith is being read and reread today, precisely because the context seems so similar, right? Huge disparities in income and wealth. This is also known as like the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, right? The robber baron era of capitalism. Violent contestations over labor. We're kind of living through and have witnessed a resurgence of labor politics in the last few years. And questions about immigration, about the resurgence of nativism and racism in American politics, and nationalism as well. I mean, there's so much about the progressive era that resonates with our contemporary moment. And so I thought it was incredibly illuminating to read how economists in that time were thinking through those problems and thinking through Smith and that they weren't completely free of their own concerns, even as they tried to be as historical as possible when they were reading and reconstructing Smith's ideas, right? They're never free from their own moment. There's this line in, I think it's E.R.A. Seligman's writings on Smith, where he says, look, Smith was a man of his time, and the way in which Smith talked about free trade is a reaction to the mercantilism of the 18th century. And then later on, he says, but there is no doubt that, you know, were Smith alive today, he would be in the vanguard of the new school, i.e., right, he would be on our side. He would side with labor. He would side with our sympathies with the labor movement because, you know, he thought labor was central and pivotal to the economy. So, you know, it's a really interesting moment, and I think certainly resonates with how I tried to read Smith and still think with and through and against Smith today, because we're always, you know, trying to balance a very historical reading of Smith and trying to understand what Smith was up to in his time, while also trying to understand why Smith is still relevant to us today based on the conditions that we're living in.
Sure. And then taking this up through the 20th century, obviously, in terms of not just economic theory, but economic policy, the Great Depression was an absolutely pivotal moment, both shaping ideas that were then utilized in the post-war period, the sort of economics that reigned in the United States, but also reaction to all of that. Can you tell us about the Chicago School of Economics, which really one could see over generations, not just one set of thinkers, but who were enormously influential in helping associate Adam Smith with the idea of the unfettered free market?
Yeah, I'm going to have to fly through a lot of this. As you said, it's a transformation that takes place over multiple generations of Chicago economists, all of whom are kind of very different in their ideology, quite different, I would say, in their ideologies and the way in which they're reading Smith. And, you know, this transformation takes place over two chapters of my book. But you're absolutely right. We got to start with the Great Depression, which is an absolutely pivotal, earth-shattering moment in U.S. economic history and really transforms or sets up a transformation in the discipline. So after the Great Depression, I kind of joke and say, you know, it's not a good time to say, it's not a good look to be defending, you know what we need? More free markets. So the discipline after the Great Depression, the discipline of economics kind of loosely coalesces around, we need some more management of the economy. Now, Chicago is interesting because Chicago is a bit of a heterodox institution, or I would say it's a last bastion of economists who are saying, actually, we think free markets are still a good idea, and the tenets of classical liberalism are still worth defending, as the rest of the discipline is kind of hunkering down on more management of the economy. So Chicago is a locus of where economists are kind of defending and unifying the substantive proposition of kind of free markets under specific conditions can still be self-regulating and self-stabilizing under the right conditions, right? And these are the principles that really tie together the different generations of Chicago economists. And those principles, right, that free markets under specific conditions can be self-regulating and self-correcting, and that rational self-interest underpins the automaticity of markets, that becomes kind of the dictum of Chicago economics by the time we get to the 1960s and 1970s with the rise of economists like George Stigler and Milton Friedman. And these two economists, I think, they're the ones that I focus on, who really whittle Smith down into two of the most powerful concepts, or two concepts that get most powerfully associated with Smith, I should say, self-interest and the invisible hand. So self-interest is this idea that kind of becomes what George Stigler called Newtonian in its universality, right? That it has the most predictive power on social coordination and predicting outcomes. And it's Smith who highlighted the power of self-interest. And that becomes associated with Smith through George Stigler's interpretation of him. And then the invisible hand, something we hear so often today, right? If you ask somebody on the street, what do they know of Adam Smith? They're like, oh, the invisible hand of the market. That is really associated with the economist Milton Friedman, who was not only an award-winning economist in his own right, but also one of the most famous and powerful public intellectuals of his time. And what he does is popularize this idea that Smith gave us the idea, the beginning of scientific economics associated with the invisible hand, right? He says the voluntary acts of millions of individuals, each pursuing his own objectives that could be coordinated without central direction through a price mechanism. And for Friedman, this idea of the invisible hand as the market, as the price mechanism, is his way of kind of transforming Smith and the market into like a vernacular, right? It makes economics accessible. It makes this really kind of complicated idea of how markets work into something really simple and really elegant. And this becomes a way of not only understanding the market itself, but an entire way of thinking about society as being organized through the natural and automatic workings of individual actors without the need to rely on government. And I think it's Friedman who really kind of sets up this duality between the market and the invisible hand and government. So this idea that we get that's very oppositional, right? That like it's the economy that should work and the government that messes things up. This is really associated with Friedman's idea or Friedman's interpretation of the invisible hand, right? We need to get the invisible hand of politics out of the invisible hand of the market. And he associates the invisible hand with freedom, right? You have to be free to choose. And it's the invisible hand that not only acts as a descriptive metaphor for how markets work and how the price mechanism works, but it becomes a normative idea, right? It becomes this idea that markets enshrine personal freedom, and that is the best form of freedom, and that we need to do everything we can to protect it, and especially when it means getting the government out of the economy. And so Friedman, I think, really transforms Smith into the Smith we know today, Smith associated with the miracle of free market capitalism.
Right. And of course, these ideas, the ideas popularized by Milton Friedman and company, don't happen in a vacuum. They precede the rise of what is called neoliberalism, in which the welfare state is cut away, in which regulation on capital becomes pulled back, and of course associated with the rise of figures like Reagan and Thatcher. And yet, of course, that also generates a backlash. And that backlash comes from the left, of course, but it also comes from the right. And I wonder if you could tell us about the form that it takes on the right.
That's absolutely right. So right as Milton Friedman is reaching his zenith, the peak of Reaganomics and Thatcherism, you have a critique of free market capitalism coming from conservatives called neoconservatives. So people like Irving Kristol and Gertrude Himmelfarb, who are actually a couple. And their critique of what you mentioned, neoliberalism, or what they would call like liberal capitalism, is not just that free markets are bad and we need to rein them in by more government intervention. What they're saying is that capitalist society can't rely on cold, calculating rationality alone. It needs morality in order to make it wholesome, so to speak. And their reading of Smith is in many ways a critique of the Friedman-Stigler, cold, hard, free market capitalism reading of Smith coming from the right. And what they're trying to say is that Smith's organic theory of morality from the theory of moral sentiments shows how moral improvement is possible, and moral improvement is possible for all people, and that individual moral agency really provides kind of a shield against the harsh forces of capitalism. And what's interesting here is that in many ways, it is still an anti, you know, statist approach to the market and to the state. They're saying the harsh forces of capitalism don't need to be reined in by government, but by individual moral agency and what they call traditional institutions like the family and like organized religion. The other critique that emerges around the same time in the late 70s and 80s comes from scholars, mostly in the United Kingdom, but also on this side of the Atlantic as well. And these are intellectual historians and political theorists who are trying to reinsert the politics back into Smith's economics. So scholars like Donald Winch, who writes this landmark work, Adam Smith's Politics, an Essay in Historiographic Revision, and István Hont, and also A.O. Hirschman, who himself was an economist, really thinking about development economics. And these three thinkers, you know, they're spread out, and they're writing very different works. But what they're starting to realize is that, you know, the Chicago School of Economics hollowed out the politics, and they're trying to put politics back into the picture. At the same time, the neoconservatives felt that, you know, free market capitalism hollowed out morality, and so we need to put morality back into the picture too.
So we saw the rise of a particular interpretation of Adam Smith's ideas in the 60s and 70s associated with the likes of Milton Friedman. And then, of course, the Great Recession, 2007, 2008, became another landmark moment in shifting the kind of ideas that would get traction. And in the wake of the Great Recession, one saw the Occupy movement and other movements of the left calling for redistribution and pushing back against the notion of free market capitalism. Now, there were critics on the left before then who had tried to recuperate parts of Adam Smith's ideas. But I wonder if you could talk about the form that that kind of reclamation from the left has taken over that period of time to the present.
Yeah, I'm going to kind of speak a little bit more anecdotally about this too, because this is exactly the point at which I entered graduate school and started working on Smith. So around the time that my interest in Smith arose, scholarship was really flourishing on this, what is now known annoyingly as kind of like the left Smith versus right Smith debate. So as you were saying, you know, starting after the Great Recession, 2008, especially after 2010, we see a real efflorescence of scholarship around Smith and questions of distributive justice, around inequality, around poverty, and the meaning of a kind of moral economy and the normative stakes of economic growth. And I think, you know, a lot of those questions arise over discontent about the current or then current status, right? Huge inequality, again, social movements, huge recessions, right? Questions about poverty, inequality, and growth are thrown into high relief. And who better to turn to than to the alleged father of capitalism himself, and to really look for the bright spots in his writing where Smith might have questioned the very theories that he is most known for. And so what we saw and what we still are seeing today, I think, is a real need to find in Smith a connection between his economics and his moral philosophy, to understand where Smith's moral commitments lie on questions of inequality, poverty, distributive justice, and growth. One of the most kind of eye-opening discussions about this is, you know, Smith on the question of inequality. For Smith, one of the most one of the most prominent readings about on Smith on inequality is really highlighting the way in which for Smith, inequality is not just a question of some people have more than others and somehow this is bad for growth, but that it's a deeply moral problem as well, that inequality distorts our sympathies, to quote the scholar Dennis Rasmussen on this, that there's something really perverse about the way in which we see people differently, the way we treat people, and we accord them different amounts of sympathy based on their material condition. And you can see how powerful that reading can be in an age of extreme inequality today. And when we think about questions of poverty and, you know, the social bases of respect, I was reading this at the same time as I was taking a class on kind of contemporary egalitarian political philosophy and these ideas of relational egalitarianism, right? That it's not just about how much we have, but how we relate to one another that matters when it comes to questions of inequality. These are so resonant, and you can see the textual resources in Smith's writings when you have an eye to reading his moral philosophy and his political economy together. And I think those questions of how it is that we read these texts together in an age of inequality are still thrown into high relief today. And that's what makes Smith kind of an ongoing, incredibly vital resource for thinking through these questions. So take the example of his critique of the British East India Company, for example, right? He does not mince his words when he critiques the oppressive, violent, extractive ways of the British East India Company, which is the most powerful company in the world at the time that he's writing in 1776. But if you were to say, you know, is he on the left or on the right? I would say that doesn't really make sense for his time or in ours. What is he actually critiquing? He's critiquing a new form of power that has emerged, in which private companies have amassed so much, you could say, soft power, that they're able to bend the state to do its will with incredibly violent and kind of unfathomable consequences. That is something that I think cuts across left and right. It is a critique of state capture, and it is a critique of a new form of power that is, again, tied to wealth and wealth that works with the state in order to oppress the public, knowingly or not. So what I think we should be more critical of when we read Smith and we read contemporary readings of Smith is to kind of go back and forth between what we want Smith to say for us today and what Smith actually said, and to see, you know, where those match up and where they don't.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with the author of Adam Smith's America, How a Scottish Philosopher Became an Icon of American Capitalism. That's published by Princeton University Press. You can find a link to it at againstthegrain.org. Glory Liu is a political theorist and historian, assistant director for the Center for Economy and Society, and assistant research professor at Johns Hopkins. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.